U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
President Biden announces plans to pull U.S. forces out of Afghanistan. And Florida Governor Ron DeSantis tangles with 60 Minutes and YouTube. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnists Kim Strassel and Bill McGurn. On Wednesday afternoon, Joe Biden is scheduled to give a speech announcing that he will pull all remaining U.S. forces from Afghanistan by September 11th. Which will be the 20th anniversary of the terrorist attacks that were planned there by Al-Qaeda. Biden's speech hasn't happened as of the time that we're taping this, but the White House press office has sent out some excerpts of his remarks as they are prepared for delivery, and they include this, quote, "We cannot continue the cycle of extending or expanding our military presence in Afghanistan, hoping to create the ideal conditions for our withdrawal, expecting a different result. I'm now the fourth American president to preside over an American troop presence in Afghanistan, two Republicans, two Democrats. I will not pass this responsibility to a fifth," unquote. Bill, what do you make of the argument that President Biden is putting forth there?
Well, in some sense, it's understandable. The American people have a lot of fatigue about this. It's so many years after 9/11. Now there's a new generation that grew up after the attacks. We still seem to be stuck in Afghanistan and with no prospect of getting out. So I suspect that, you know, it appeals to that segment of the population that is, you know, asking what are we there for, and hasn't it been long enough? Now that said, the story of life is story of long presences. You know, we still have a presence in Germany after World War II. We have presence in South Korea and Japan. And there's a reason for that. It's very stabilizing. Sometimes there aren't good choices, and that this is the best of bad choices. We have two pretty big examples. You know, we ignored Afghanistan as this country of just, you know, sandy mountains and so forth. And people, we ignored it for many years. And then they came down and knocked down two of our buildings in Midtown Manhattan because we ignored it and the sanctuary it had become for terrorists. So I think ignoring it, there is a price to ignoring it. And we don't want to invite that again. And the other example we have related is Iraq. You know, when Barack Obama pulled out of Iraq against the advice of his generals and so forth, there were similar arguments. Why are we there? You know, it's just a messed up country. It's not our problem and so forth. Well, then overnight, we had the rise of ISIS and so forth, who were, you know, it killed some Americans. So, you know, I'm very suspect of this, and I know it plays. You get cheap applause initially. But I think the editorial the Journal has it right that the president is responsible for what happens after. Are we going to see another ISIS situation develop or something else? And he's going to bear the responsibilities for that.
Yeah, I mean, that does seem to be the question of what happens next. And the alternatives do not seem all that appealing either. I mean, the argument here, Kim, is that in the absence of any American aid forces on the ground there, Afghanistan could essentially turn into a kind of security vacuum. And notably, the Taliban that is still there has not cut its ties with Al-Qaeda. So is this, Kim, something of a strategic gamble by Biden that won't happen?
It's a huge gamble. And, you know, Bill's right to remember how we first got there 20 years ago. You had a Taliban in control that was offering the country as a sanctuary to Al-Qaeda. And here we are 20 years later, and the Taliban is again resurgent. It is seeking to retake Kabul. It's seeking to reestablish an Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. There are peace talks going on, but without the United States engaged and backing the Afghan government, they will likely fail. And all kinds of terrible things will likely ensue. I mean, again, it's more likely that the Taliban will gain control again. You'll probably see the reemergence of the Northern Alliance, which is going to step back up to be a protection against the Taliban. There'll be a civil war. And again, the possibility that Afghanistan goes right back to what we were concerned about 20 years ago as a haven, not just for Al-Qaeda, but Islamic State and other militant groups that have risen in the past 20 years. And so, you know, this is history potentially repeating itself. And I think one of the unfortunate things here is that a lot of people have come to conflate in their head that original goal of why we went in there and what we were attempting to do with this kind of country forming or country creating project that the U.S. forces have also helped with over time. And it's a security issue that really matters here. And, you know, we have a relatively small force that, as Bill said, provides stability. That should be the main question, not arbitrary timelines, etc.
And in the excerpts of Biden's speech, at least that we have so far, he doesn't seem to quite grapple with the possibility of what could come next. I'll read a couple of other lines. He says, while we will not stay in Afghanistan militarily, our diplomatic and humanitarian work will continue. We will continue to support the government of Afghanistan. We will keep providing assistance to the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces, unquote. But Bill, I mean, in absence of American help on the ground there, it's worth keeping in mind that it's not at all clear how well that government of Afghanistan can stand up on its own.
Yes, exactly. Look, I'm sure tonight the Taliban is going to be quaking in its boots, hearing that the United States is going to continue its diplomatic efforts against them. Look, the Taliban is an extraordinarily rugged organization. And they've survived all these years of war against them. And they've always maintained sooner or later, the United States will cut and run. The long-term argument for going is one, the question is whether this government can stand without a U.S. military presence. This is not the first time. We've had these questions in South Korea, in Taiwan, in Asia. You know, when I lived in Asia 30 years ago, it was a different kind of Asia. South Korea and Taiwan were not democracies. They were dictatorships. And South Korea was particularly unstable. There were all these protests and things, and you had the North on the border. Our presence there really, it had costs. You know, some of our soldiers got killed along the DMZ. It had costs, but I think you would have to argue that on the whole, it helped channel Asia in the right direction. It prevented China from getting too powerful, kept the sea lanes of communication over. I think the argument for doing that in Afghanistan is not that it's the best choice we have. It's the best of a lot of bad choices. And if we can do that in the Middle East, come to some rough peace agreements that I think we did start to see under Donald Trump, would be well worth it, because the cost of ignoring it and then coming back when an ISIS is big enough to fight us, I think is a real mistake. I do think that the irony is that the Trump administration shared this kind of view with the Biden administration. Let's just get out and come home. The Trump administration, I think, will in the end prove more willing to use force, you know, is more comfortable with the use of force. And I think that will be one of the challenges for Joe Biden. It's very rare to find a Democrat who is willing and comfortable using American force to protect American interests. And the purpose of a presence is to minimize that force and to make sure it doesn't get too far.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Kim, a moment ago you mentioned the specific timeline set out for this, and that seems to be something that opponents of Biden's decision are talking about. So I'll read a quote here from Republican Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma. Here's how he characterized the decision. He says, "This is a reckless and dangerous decision. Arbitrary timelines would likely put our troops in danger, jeopardize all the progress we've made, lead to civil war in Afghanistan, and create a breeding ground for international terrorists." And part of what I think is the interesting argument there is this issue about setting the date 9/11. I get there's symbolic value in that, but does that suggest that it's elevating the symbolic value of that over the strategic considerations?
Oh, absolutely. And look, I mean, we want to be fair here. Mr. Biden didn't inherit the best situation in that his predecessor, Donald Trump, had negotiated a May 1st withdrawal, which was too soon. And it was precipitous and had not been well planned. And the Biden administration noted that they simply couldn't hit that deadline. But then to come out and say, oh, 9/11 seems just as sort of arbitrary and precipitous. And it seems to be driven more by politics than it does by a reasonable analysis of things on the ground. And, you know, just to further this, too, it's going to set into motion. There's about 10,000 foreign forces right now that are in Afghanistan. About 3,500 of those are Americans. But it's worth pointing out that as we leave, others are going to leave as well, too. This could all collapse very quickly if the Biden administration doesn't step back and just think about this really from a more strategic standpoint. Can I just also throw one more thing in here too, because people aren't really getting into it, but it's something that having been around during 9/11 and remembering why we went in, it wasn't just about terrorism too. I mean, right now the Biden administration is talking about how they deal, for instance, with the Chinese terrible treatment of the Uyghurs, etc. Let's not forget that the Taliban, you know, these guys conform to a brutal form of Sharia law. And Afghanistan was the center of international outrage during their rule because of their stoning of women and destroying antiquities and denying girls and young women schooling and banning kite flying and basically committing massacres of, you know, members of their communities there. And so we also have to ask the question if we're willing to simply sit back and let that happen in the country again, too.
Yeah, it's a good point, and a separate one from the security considerations. But on the latter, Bill, I mean, what about the argument you sometimes hear that even if the United States doesn't have troops on the ground, if Al-Qaeda gets a foothold somewhere, sets up some sort of training camp or whatnot, I mean, that's what we have predator drones for example. And even without boots on the ground, the United States has ways to exert force when it needs to prevent terrorist plotting and terrorist attacks.
That's true up to a point. And I'm glad we have those things. And those things have allowed us to be a lot more precise in our targeting. But I don't think they're a substitute for having people on the ground. I mean, I think we found that with ISIS and so forth. I think this is a comforting excuse or rationale you give yourself for doing something. You know, ironically, given Trump's instincts on taking our troops out of there, you know, why the heck are we, you know, fighting other people's wars or giving them a free defense? One thing Joe Biden could do that would both be good for the country and I think distinguish himself from Trump is he could enhance our alliances, our defense alliances and so forth. I think he could enhance, for example, a trade alliance that he used to be for that could be used to counter China, you know, if the neighboring countries were with us. And that would mean we're not in these things alone. I think he could do that with NATO. I think there's a lot of areas where he could do that that would be a good corrective to President Trump, I think, who is too inclined to go it alone and so forth. But I don't see him doing that. I think that's the problem. I think this is just straight out, let's get out of here. And they're banking on that even if bad things happen as long as it doesn't happen to Americans, it's not going to affect us. And again, ISIS gave us really brutal examples of what happens, you know, in the Middle East when you leave a security vacuum.
Right. And Kim, I mean, the other thing to keep in mind with ISIS is then you ended up with U.S. forces back on the ground where they had left just not too long previously.
Right. And this obviously is the risk. And it keeps coming back to the point that we've been stressing here about America's own security interests. And you have to look at the alternative. You know, we have a bipartisan Afghanistan study group that said that about 4,500 American troops would be enough to train and advise and assist Afghan defense forces and support our partners there and conduct what counterterrorism operations we need to do and keep our embassy safe. You know, that's not an enormous commitment. It's certainly not one that keeps us from dealing with our other adversaries in the world. As Bill has mentioned, we have had presences in other parts of the world for long times, which have served to be a stabilizing a force in those areas. And it still is a bit, it's unusual to me. I understand that we went in there in a war type context, but it is kind of unusual to me that we haven't at all modified our thinking to kind of think of this as a security force and a presence rather than an act of conflict.
Finally, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is back in the headlines. And let's start with this controversy over a YouTube video. He hosted a sort of policy discussion with creators of the Great Barrington Declaration, this group of physicians, scientists who were opposed to COVID lockdowns. And Bill, the YouTube video was taken down.
Yes, it was. And he's been complaining about censorship. And I think he has a point there. There are a lot of areas that, you know, there's a lot of things we can contest about COVID, a lot of things we still don't know. And I think largely for political reasons, they've gone after Governor DeSantis. And rather than debate him, the effort is to suppress him. So I think he has a good I think he has a clear case for attacking YouTube on this. Aren't we supposed to be able to discuss these things back and forth? It doesn't seem so. It seems that what we're supposed to do is eliminate one side of the argument.
Well, what YouTube says about this video is that there was some discussion about children wearing masks, whether it was appropriate for given the age ranges that some of these kids are in. And Kim, I mean, YouTube has this policy on COVID misinformation. Does it have any point there?
No. And the thing that actually kind of just is mind blowing to me on this particular subject is that particularly that this is a question of science and the very basis of science is questioning and pushing back. And I'm not quite sure where we got to a time in humanity where all of our scientists now say, well, there's this unknown named group of experts and what they say is goes. And anybody who questions that or in any way opposes it is somehow engaged in misinformation. The very idea behind scientists is that you put out a theory and then the way it's supposed to work is you're supposed to question that and tear it down and see if it holds up to the facts. And the thing that was also kind of remarkable here is that among the people that were sitting there talking with DeSantis was a Harvard Medical School professor, Martin Kulldorff, and a Stanford University professor, Jay Bhattacharya. And why is it that somehow their medical interpretations don't matter, don't count? But again, YouTube has this unknown group of quote experts, I guess the World Health Organization. It's taking sides in that and it's going to shut down any opposing scientific viewpoints.
Yeah, I mean, to my eye, this is a clear failure of their policy. I understand they don't want to host anti-vaccine propaganda, saying that there are microchips going into your bloodstream, or I mean, wild stuff like that. And I don't envy the position that they're in. There are like 500 hours of video that are uploaded to YouTube every minute, and in all sorts of languages. And so it's a hard business, but it does seem clear to me, Bill, that a governor discussing a policy with a bunch of doctorates is pretty clearly within the Overton window and also ought to be thought of as giving people information about what their government is doing. And the interesting thing about this is there are all sorts of conversations going on about regulating big tech, maybe at the federal level, or maybe there are questions about what states can do on their own by passing bills. And failures like this by big tech, I think, Bill, just is sort of almost invite it.
Yeah, they certainly invite it. Look, I think you give them too much credit. They're not people like you who are interested in a real debate and so forth. I think they don't like Governor DeSantis because of his politics, because he dissents from some of the pet orthodoxies, and they're going to punish him. And I think that view is widely shared among big tech, which is why there's a lot of animosity toward it in the American public. And this is going to come to a head. This is just one of several examples. As you point out, if a governor with some respected scientists can't discuss things and can't even raise certain issues in this way, then we're in really bad shape. We're not having a real debate. And we've further, just to take, this was about masks for kids, right? But just to take it further, we've learned recently, for example, that a lot of these things that are presented as sacred holy writ, the 6-foot line, well, the CDC says 3 feet is now. A lot of this stuff is arbitrary, and we should be able to discuss it, and we should be able to discuss it in terms of relative risk. I mean, nothing is risk-free, or nothing, and nothing closes all risks. And we should be having intelligent conversations on, for example, which of all the things that we're asked to do to deal with COVID are the most effective. Is it masks, or is it opening up your house to better circulation? I'd like to know. We don't get any of that. We just get this sort of tablets coming down from the mountain saying, thou shalt do this, thou shalt do that, with no explanation. And I, for one, want to hear the science, and I want to hear what different people have looking at the same information.
The other story involving Ron DeSantis is this issue about 60 Minutes issuing a news report essentially accusing him of pay for play. And as far as I can tell, that allegation has not held up very well. But Kim, what's the story here?
Well, it's a pretty embarrassing story for 60 Minutes, in that basically the allegation was that Ron DeSantis provided a special deal to a pharmacy to Publix on vaccinations in return for money to his campaign. It's simply not true. The governor went through in great detail, and it's been backed up even by Democrats in the states. The process by which Publix was chosen to deliver vaccines and the fact that other pharmacies were engaged dealing with long-term facilities or elder care facilities. So it didn't have any real kind of factual basis. And it was remarkable how quickly that story fell apart. The media didn't help itself by not simply admitting the error, but kind of doubling down. So real egg on the face there.
Yeah, I mean, there have been a lot of stories in the wake of this about how that arrangement with Publix was arrived at in, again, as far as I can tell, a nonpartisan manner by people trying to figure out what the best way to deliver these vaccines is. But Bill, it's also interesting that part of DeSantis's complaint is that he was confronted by a reporter at a news conference, a press event. And he gave a very long explanation that was very trimmed down for what eventually aired.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. He defended himself and gave details, and in the editing, a lot of those details were left out. So, it questions the good faith of the people putting it forward. If you have the goods on someone and you put them forward, presumably you should allow them to give their defense, because it's not going to affect your case. It's very solid. The problem is that they had a thesis that this was pay to play. They had some evidence of a contribution, but they just didn't have the story. That wasn't there, and it was continues to be contradicted by different people along the way, saying how they made decisions and so forth. And as Kim mentioned, like the mayor of Palm Beach, a Democrat, says this isn't what happened. So, if you're going to accuse someone of that, you should have the goods. And they just didn't. And they've been really embarrassed by it.
All right. Thank you, Kim and Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.